The Public Affairs Department of the American Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation, presents transcribed Reflections on Being 80 by Bertrand Russell. For the past 6 weeks, ABC has presented Bertrand Russell in a series of lectures on the topic Living in an Atomic Age. In this series, Lord Russell outlined and discussed the problems confronting man living in this atomic age and offered his solution to the problems. In these talks, Lord Russell brought to bear all of his years of reasoning and contemplation. The culmination of his ideas regarding the world and mankind's place in the world was embodied in this series. He attempted to point the way for man by outlining the conflicts confronting him, by urging the understanding of these conflicts in order to bring about a community of interest that would unify the human family and bring about a peaceful and harmonious world. It'll be interesting, then, to discover the reasoning and thoughts whereby Bertrand Russell reached his conclusions. In May 1952, Lord Russell was 80. And so it is a fitting close to the summation of his ideas and world outlook presented in the preceding series to offer this talk this evening, wherein the eminent philosopher looks back over his 80 years, reflecting on his life's work and on the successes and failures of the goals he set for himself as a young man. In this talk, we are able to learn through Lord Russell's analysis of his own life how he attained the philosophical outlook concerning mankind and the world, which he presented in his summary of Man Living in an Atomic Age. And now, here is Lord Russell.
On reaching the age of 80, it is reasonable to suppose that the bulk of one's work is done, and that what remains to do will be of less importance. The serious part of my life, ever since boyhood, has been devoted to two different objects, which for a long time remained separate, and have only in recent years united into a single whole. I wanted, on the one hand, to find out whether anything could be known, and on the other hand, to do whatever might be possible towards creating a happier world. Up to the age of 38, I gave most of my energies to the first of these tasks. I was troubled by skepticism, and unwillingly forced to the conclusion that most of what passes for knowledge is open to reasonable doubt. I wanted certainty in the kind of way in which people want religious faith. I thought that certainty is more likely to be found in mathematics than elsewhere. But I discovered that many mathematical demonstrations, which my teachers expected me to accept, were full of fallacies, and that if certainty were indeed discoverable in mathematics, it would be in a new kind of mathematics, with more solid foundations than those that had hitherto been thought secure. But as the work proceeded, I was continually reminded of the fable about the elephant and the tortoise. Having constructed an elephant upon which the mathematical world could rest, I found the elephant tottering and proceeded to construct a tortoise to keep the elephant from falling. But the tortoise was no more secure than the elephant, and after some 20 years of very arduous toil, I came to the conclusion that there was nothing more that I could do in the way of making mathematical knowledge indubitable. Then came the First World War, and my thoughts became concentrated on human misery and folly. Neither misery nor folly seems to me any part of the inevitable lot of man, and I am convinced that intelligence, patience, and eloquence can, sooner or later, lead the human race out of its self-imposed tortures, provided it does not exterminate itself meanwhile. On the basis of this belief, I have had always a certain degree of optimism, although as I have grown older, the optimism has grown more sober and the happy issue more distant. But I remain completely incapable of agreeing with those who accept fatalistically the view that man is born to trouble. The causes of unhappiness in the past and in the present are not difficult to ascertain. There have been poverty, pestilence, and famine which were due to man's inadequate mastery of nature. There have been wars, oppressions, and tortures which have been due to men's hostility to their fellow men. And there have been morbid miseries fostered by gloomy creeds which have led men into profound inner discords that made all outward prosperity of no avail. All these are unnecessary. In regard to all of them, means are known by which they can be overcome. In the modern world, if communities are unhappy, it is because they choose to be so. Or, to speak more precisely, because they have ignorances, habits, beliefs, and passions which are dearer to them than happiness or even life. I find many men in our dangerous age who seem to be in love with misery and death, and who grow angry when hopes are suggested to them. They think that hope is irrational, and that in sitting down to lazy despair, they are merely facing facts. I cannot agree with these men. To preserve hope in our world makes calls upon our intelligence and our energy. In those who despair, it is very frequently the energy that is lacking. The last half of my life has been lived in one of those painful epochs of human history during which the world is getting worse, and past victories which had seemed to be definitive have turned out to be only temporary. When I was young, Victorian optimism was taken for granted. It was thought that freedom and prosperity would spread gradually throughout the world by orderly process, and it was hoped that cruelty, tyranny, and injustice would continually diminish. Hardly anyone was haunted by the fear of great wars. Hardly any thought of the 19th century as a brief interlude between past and future barbarism. For those who grew up in that atmosphere, adjustment to the world of the present has been difficult. It has been difficult not only emotionally, but intellectually. Ideas that had been thought adequate have proved inadequate. In some directions, valuable freedoms have proved very hard to preserve. In other directions, especially as regards relations between nations, freedoms formerly valued have proved potent sources of disaster. New thoughts, new hopes, new freedoms, and new restrictions upon freedom are needed if the world is to emerge from its present perilous state. I cannot pretend that what I have done in regard to social and political problems has had any great importance. It is comparatively easy to have an immense effect by means of a dogmatic and precise gospel such as that of communism. But for my part, I cannot believe that what mankind needs is anything either precise or dogmatic. Nor can I believe with any wholeheartedness in any partial doctrine which deals only with some part or aspect of human life. There are those who hold that everything depends upon institutions, and that good institutions will inevitably bring the millennium. And on the other hand, there are those who believe that what is needed is a change of heart, and that, in comparison, institutions are of little account. I cannot accept either view. Institutions mold character, and character transforms institutions. Reforms in both must march hand in hand. And if individuals are to retain that measure of initiative and flexibility which they ought to have, they must not be all forced into one rigid mold, or, to change the metaphor, all drilled into one army. Diversity is essential, in spite of the fact that it precludes universal acceptance of a single gospel. But to preach such a doctrine is difficult, especially in arduous times, and perhaps it cannot be effective until some bitter lessons have been learnt by tragic experience. My work is near its end, and the time has come when I can survey it as a whole. How far have I succeeded, and how far have I failed? From an early age, I thought of myself as dedicated to great and arduous tasks. 55 years ago, walking alone in the Tiergarten through melting snow under the coldly glittering March sun, I determined to write two series of books. One abstract, growing gradually more concrete. The other concrete, growing gradually more abstract. They were to be crowned by a synthesis, combining pure theory with a practical social philosophy. Except for the final synthesis, which still eludes me, I have written these books. They have been acclaimed and praised, and the thoughts of many men and women have been affected by them. To this extent, I have succeeded. But as against this must be set two kinds of failure, one outward, one inward. I have lived in the pursuit of a vision, both personal and social. Personal, to care for what is noble, for what is beautiful, for what is gentle. To allow moments of insight, to give wisdom at more mundane times. Social, to see in imagination the society that is to be created, where individuals grow freely, and where hate and greed and envy die because there is nothing to nourish them. These things I believe, and the world, for all its horrors, has left me unshaken.
Thank you, Lord Russell. We have just heard a talk by the distinguished English philosopher and mathematician Bertrand Russell entitled Reflections on Being 80. A transcribed feature of the ABC Public Affairs Department in cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation. This is George Gunn speaking from New York. This is ABC Radio Network.